Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I am Jamie, and I am here with John. What is up?
I mean, is it bad to say we're still snowed in?
Believe it or not, still snowed in. No school, activities canceled.
I'm losing hope.
There's a path from my house to John's to record, and that's pretty much all we got.
That's the only path in the entire county right now. So yeah. I've never seen anything like it, but you're not here to talk about weather with two old men, but it is a crime.
It is. It's a crime against humanity that it is just not going away. It hasn't even done anything in the last day or so, but just not going away. Like a lot of the stories we talk about, right? And this is one that, you know, it's it needs to be told. And that's one thing we focus on when picking the cases that we cover. A lot come in via recommendation and try to get to cases that not a lot of people have heard or cases that need more light. And that's where we're going today.
Yeah, this is a very interesting case. It's one really unlike any that I can remember where we don't have any questions about what happened. But I guess the biggest question is why.
That's the lingering one. And I think we'll give our takes at the end. But without further ado, why don't you get us rolling?
So we're going to be going to a small town, Brandon, Mississippi. It's a quiet community. It's where a local school teacher's life was violently cut short by someone that no one would have expected, and that was her own daughter. So on March 19th, 2024, which is just last year, I mean, it's almost a year ago. That's hard. No.
It's 2 years, two years ago. It's all right, buddy.
Golly,
we've been snowed in since last year. It's good.
Time is flying by. So on March 19th, 2024, 40-year-old Ashley Nicole Smiley, who was, again, a respected math teacher at Northwest Rankin High School, she was shot and killed inside her own home by her 14-year-old daughter, Carly Madison Gregg. Jamie, this case is so brutal. It is awful to think that a 14-year-old daughter could kill their own mom. It is kind of hard for me to even imagine because I also have a 14-year-old daughter.
Yeah, yeah. And most of the time, especially when firearms are involved, it seems to be male teenagers that are involved in violence. We don't see this very often with teenage girls or with that inside the home and the girl being the assailant.
This case is wild because there are so many documents that we could show, or there's audio and video recording from inside the home. So again, there's no question who shot and killed Ashley.
I think this is kind of what people expect life to be like in every crime, is that everything's caught on video. We have video, we have audio everywhere. We record everything in our lives nowadays. We're recording us talking about this.
We do. My house is different though. I have recording and surveillance devices all over the exterior of my house, but none on the interior. I have an opportunity for one because it came with my like surveillance footage package or whatever. But I did set it up for a minute and it was just on like a exit or entrance into the house.
Right.
But there is footage from inside this home.
Right.
When this happened.
Did you make that decision intentionally to protect some kind of privacy, or was it just because I'm the same way. My house is, the outer layer has all kinds of cameras. I don't have any inside. I assume if something happens inside, I will have seen that person come in already.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's just a privacy thing. I don't want to feel like I'm being recorded inside my own home. And I just assume that everybody in my home is trustworthy. And if a bad guy gets in my house, they have to get in from the outside and I will have video of that.
What if I don't think everybody in my house is, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
No. I have a place where I would probably put a camera in your house.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And maybe alarms.
Yes.
Kidding.
A few. No, I'm with you on that. 'Cause there is an element of feels like spying on your family. I know a lot of people have nanny cams for when babysitters or nannies are over, so not knocking that, but I've not chosen to do that.
And maybe if that was a thing that I needed back then, I would have done it.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with doing it. I don't do it.
Sure. I totally get it. But this family did. So that's why we have all the information that we have to dissect what happened here and to try to get to the why. Let's start by talking a little more about Ashley. She was born April 11th, 1983, and spent her adult life dedicated to education. She taught mathematics, which is near and dear to my heart. That's my degree and my profession. And like you said, she taught at Northwest Rankin High School in Brandon, Mississippi. Students and colleagues remembered Ashley as somebody who cared about her students. She cared about them being successful both inside and outside of the classroom. A true mentor. I think that's what, as a parent of teenagers, that's what I want from all of my kids' teachers, is for them to actually care about my kids' well-being. But before being a teacher, she was a mother. She was married to Heath Smiley, who was a physical therapist assistant who worked only minutes away from their house, so he was always close by. Together, Ashley and Heath raised two daughters. Carly was a surviving child. The family had previously lost another daughter named Natalie, who was born with spinal muscular atrophy and died as an infant. Super sad story, so this family's already seen some trauma there. Friends and family say Ashley was devoted, hardworking, and not somebody who ever seemed to be a danger. She should never be in danger, which makes what happened inside their home that much more shocking and devastating.
So now let's talk about Carly. Again, she's 14 years old. She was born on April 23rd, 2009 in Starksville, Mississippi. She was a ninth grade student at the same school that her mom taught at, the Northwest Rankin High School. According to police reports, on the afternoon of March 19th, Carly arrived back at home with her mother after school that day. Security camera footage shown from the home shows her walking past rooms in the house before eventually gunshots would ring out. So the weapon that was used was a .357 Magnum handgun. It was owned by Ashley. It was kept in Ashley and her husband Heath's bedroom. Carly retrieved it from underneath the mattress before the shooting, which I'm not saying anything about Ashley or Heath and their gun habits, but all firearms should be locked up. Under right. A mattress is not a safe place. That's a very old school thing to do.
My grandma used to do that, and I was scared to death that she was going to have a bad dream and just lay into people.
Yeah, I love my right to bear arms, but I think you have to have a lot of diligence in making sure they're safe and secure.
Just to emphasize, I know what you're saying is we're not laying any blame on Ashley and Heath for what happened, just noting that there are safe ways to store a firearm.
I am not trying to blame them for what happened, but just as a note, like, we both know families who have lost people because of accidental shootings. Yeah. So just making sure those are secure is very, very important.
Yeah, and a .357 is not a tiny gun. That's not your 9 or your .380 pistol that most people conceal and carry. A .357 is a weapon.
This is if you watch any Westerns, this is a revolver most often, and it is a big gun. I mean, it will break your wrists. I say that joking. It will kick you, though, when you shoot it.
It will. Clint Eastwood.
It brings a punch.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood rocks those in a lot of movies. So to be clear, she found a large-scale pistol.
Things get worse, too, in the moments after the shooting. And, Jamie, you can get more into that.
Yeah, courtroom footage and testimony showed that Carly fired 3 shots that struck her mother in the head and neck. And those wounds would prove fatal. After the shooting, Carly didn't immediately leave. Instead, surveillance video inside the home showed her walking back through the home, clutching her cell phone and texting somebody. According to testimony, she used her mom's phone to text her stepfather, Heath, asking when he would be home, effectively luring him back to the house. Because remember, he just worked a few minutes away, so...
So I thought that when I heard this, she would be trying to get him to stay gone longer. But no, she, in a sinister way, wants him to come back sooner than later.
Right. This wasn't stay out and work all day, go pick something up so I can clean up. This was, you need to get over here. And when he came back.
And he thinks that it's Ashley texting him because right. It's from her phone.
Excellent point. He thought it was his wife. And when he came in, he saw her bloody body. And he approached the house. And when he got inside, he was shot in the shoulder by Carly. Now, he would survive his wound and was able to physically wrestle the gun away from Carly. You know, you see people in movies do this often of, I get shot, but I keep fighting. I can't physically imagine that, taking a slug from a .357 and then tackling somebody.
No, and it from what I remember in my research, he basically opened the door and had a gun in his face. So yeah. He put his hand up to block it and got shot there before he was able to move it for the other two shots.
Right. And a lot of adrenaline going there, but he did get the weapon away from Carly. And that's when she took off out of the house, jumped over the backyard fence, and was later found just a short distance away and was ultimately taken into custody for the shooting.
Yeah. Police were called immediately after Heath was shot. And the police presence was very, very fast. Once officers arrived, they found Carly just a moment or two away from the house. She didn't make it very far. And she was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and tampering with evidence. The latter for hiding a kitchen surveillance camera inside the refrigerator after the shooting of her mother. Given the severity of the charges and the nature of the crime, she was only 14 years old, but prosecutors sought to try Carly as an adult. And this was a decision that raised significant legal and ethical questions, really just due to her age. Again, just 14 years old. And this is in 2024. So,
all right. Yeah, this wasn't the 90s when we're looking to hang everybody.
And I guess, she was only a month away from 15, which I still don't know that changes anything, even if she was only 15.
I would still categorize that as early adolescence.
But to me, I don't know, if you're capable of shooting your mother and trying to shoot your stepdad, maybe you should be tried as an adult.
You know, we've had so many of these over the years, and I go back and forth depending on the circumstances. And this one, I don't know that I can take a strong stance on either side of it because she is so young. But she also texted somebody and lured them into the house to shoot them. So that's a tough one for me.
She also had a friend show up at the house before her dad got there. She didn't say why. She asked the friend to come over, but she didn't tell the friend why. So when the friend got there, they learned, oh my God, you've killed your mom. And, you know, then she surprised the friend by saying, oh wait, I'm going to need you to hide because my stepdad's here and I'm going to kill him now too. So this was a very unwilling participant who just came over because she thought that her friend needed something.
Right. And that's another layer of malice coming from Carly of casually inviting her friend over and be like, just hide for a second. I got to shoot my stepdad. Then we'll get back to it.
When the friend got there, Carly allegedly asked the friend, how do you feel about seeing dead bodies? And then she would go on to say, yeah, I put three in my mom. Like, just very cold and inhumane.
And obviously that goes to one of two ways, right? Just completely sinister and evil. And you have to ask how that could exist in a 14-year-old. Or was there something more going on with her mental state? We get back from a break. We'll dive into Carly's mental health and see if that can help us answer the big question of why did she kill her mother? The trial began less than 6 months after the shooting, which is so fast for a murder case. That's just wild to me. And one of the first questions they tackled was Carly's mental health. Her defense attorneys explored whether she was competent to stand trial at all, whether she understood the nature of her actions in committing the shootings. A psychologist, however, by the prosecution testified that Carly did not meet Mississippi's standard for an insanity defense and that she was fully aware of what she was doing. Evidence presented included her own statements, her behavior, how she moved about after the shooting, use of her cell phone, use of her mom's cell phone, and the deliberate action toward her stepfather of luring him over to the house to shoot him, which prosecutors showed a complete understanding of her actions, no break from reality, no circumstances that forced the issue here. Defense experts and testimony from family offered a different perspective. They included a diagnosis of depression and adjustment disorder. I don't know what adjustment disorder is, John. Do you?
An adjustment disorder is basically that there's been something in your life that has been challenging for you to overcome. And so you just have some manifestations of that.
Yeah. So a trauma, impact of long-term trauma, probably. She had lost a sister. I know that's something that John works with kids all the time, so I knew you'd know that. Good job. But so she had depression, adjustment disorder, and they were trying to get her ruled insane to not stand trial. John, I know that both of those issues can lead to various actions that you may not do without them, but I don't think either of those account for like a mental break or inability to understand what you're doing. And because of that, the court ruled that she was competent to stand trial.
There's some other issues that we'll get to that could make those things a little more complicated. But for now, let's just keep going. So throughout the nearly week-long trial, both the prosecution and the defense presented extensive testimony. Again, while the shooting itself may not have been on a video recording, it was all captured on audio. But then her movements in and about the house, some of that was captured on video as well. So security footage from inside the house, including the moments leading up to and immediately after the shootings, was shown to the jury. And it became some of the most disturbing and discussed evidence of the case. Again, most of the time a jury is hearing all of the reasons why we think the person is guilty of murder. They knew this person murdered Ashley.
Yeah.
They heard it. That had to be so traumatic for everybody.
Absolutely. And as you can tell, the defense isn't saying she wasn't there, she didn't do it. That doesn't necessarily come up because of the video. Now, I will say 2024 was just 2 years ago. 2026, I think we're talking about whether the video was authentic or not.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think this was kind of a sweet spot.
Witnesses included school staff. There were neighbors, police officers, most poignantly, Heath, her stepdad, who described discovering his wife's body and being shot moments after that. And so the emotional weight of this testimony, all of these testimonies, especially from Heath, who had just lost his spouse and then survived being shot himself, part of me would like to have been in the courtroom just to, this had to be a very, very powerful statement from him.
And then they had testimony from somebody attesting to the friend that came over, and that prosecutors used to argue not only that she understood what she was doing, but that she was proud of it. She was very deliberate and, like you said, just eerily calm about the entire thing. Defense attorneys argued that Carly's age, the mental health struggles we've discussed, and emotional state should be given weight in considering her culpability and appropriate sentence. Again, what you're not hearing here is our client didn't do it. They also pointed to the intense pressure of a trial involving such extreme circumstances and argued that Carly was overwhelmed by the events beyond typical teenage experience. Well, she also created events beyond typical teenage experience, so I'm not sure I can buy into that one, but this had to be, like you said, traumatic for everybody. I was almost seated on a couple of violent trials, and I'm very thankful that I wasn't, because you have to see these things. And they're not only looking at photos, which are still traumatic, but actually seeing things happen, hearing things happen, evidence we don't ever have, but kind of tied their hands, I think.
One of the aspects at trial was the broader family dynamic going on inside the Smiley home in the months leading up to the shooting. So testimony revealed that Ashley was not only Carly's mother, but also one of her teachers at the Northwest Rankin High School, which prosecutors suggested blurred boundaries between home and school. Witnesses described Ashley as a strict but involved parent who closely monitored Carly's academics, behavior, and social life. I can tell you that when I was in high school, it's funny, when I was in middle school, my mom was a substitute teacher, so she would be in and out of the school. When I got to high school, she had a full-time job as a teacher's aide, so she was always there. And as if that's not enough, she got a job at a college, and I got to go to school for free. So my mom was with me for middle school, high school, and college. It worked out great for my mom and I, but there were times where she just knew too much. You know right. what I mean?
And so, I would imagine there's some paperwork there to suggest that you needed to be supervised at all times.
There, you know, you're not wrong, but there were people in school that she knew, like, hey, John, don't hang out with those people because they're a bad influence.
But we all also had classmates whose parents were teachers, and yeah. a lot of times in those classes, and I'm sure it was awkward, but a lot of people do it and deal with it, and it's fine.
You don't want to work at a school and have your own kid as a problem child at that school.
Right.
So yeah. I'm sure that she was strict because she didn't want, you know, her coworkers to think anyway about her.
Right. How are you going to take your teacher seriously if their own kid doesn't listen to them?
There were no pieces of evidence presented that suggested any kind of abuse, but the prosecution acknowledged that there had been some typical parent-teen conflicts in the home, including some discipline that was related to school and also to electronics use, which, I mean, welcome to any home with parents who love their children.
No, I'm totally not familiar. That doesn't happen every day at my house.
Prosecutors argued these tensions did not excuse any kind of violence, but it did help provide some context for her emotional state and possible resentment towards her mom. And the defense leaned heavily into this context, emphasizing that Carly had struggled socially. She had dealt with grief related to the loss of her infant sister years earlier and had been receiving mental health treatment prior to the shooting. Specifically, she had switched medications for depression a week before the shooting.
Yeah, that's huge.
She was taking Zoloft and then switched to Lexapro a week before the shooting. And I have some feelings about that. I don't know if you're comfortable getting into those or not, but maybe towards the end I can share a little bit more about
that. Yeah, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
They argued that Carly's emotional development had stalled and that she had lacked the impulse control and judgment of an adult, which is a critical factor when you're considering guilt and sentencing as one who is being tried as an adult.
Yeah, we're about to shift gears, so I don't want to leave the drug conversation, the medication situation. She's not out there doing cocaine. Yeah, what's your take? I have been on antidepressants, and I've been on various antidepressants, and there's always the expectation presented by the physician of watch yourself closely when you start this. If things are going south, let me know immediately.
Yeah, and I have been too. So it's not that I'm speaking out of something that I've never experienced, because I've been on those as well.
I know you also work with teenagers all the time, so I assume you've seen it and heard about it there.
Carly had some underlying issues. She had some mental health issues that she had attempted to cut her. She had cut herself before. So that's a very, very dangerous thing, of course. And when you're taking any kind of antidepressant, especially when you're just getting started, that is the most critical time to watch for any other signs of feeling like you want to hurt yourself. So I don't think Lexapro is a drug that caused this child to shoot and murder her own mom. But I think that it can definitely impact your mental state. So this is really, really challenging. And I think it really should be factored into this decision the court has to make.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I don't think you can place all the blame on that medication or just a change in medication, but it is part of the formula that led to what happened. So, no, I completely appreciate that. And those were things that the defense was relying on. But the prosecution focused a lot on Carly's behavior after the shooting, which they described as chilling and deliberate. Jurors were shown footage of Carly walking around the house, placing a kitchen security camera in the fridge just in case somebody saw something on that, using her phone while her mother was laying there dead. not sitting and crying and sobbing, what have I done? Not sitting and pondering life, texting her friend to come over, getting her mom's phone, texting her stepfather to come home. Prosecutors argued that this behavior demonstrated awareness, intent, and an understanding of wrongdoing, which are key elements in overcoming the defense's argument about diminished emotional and mental capacity. The defense countered that trauma responses can vary widely, especially in adolescence, and that shock can present as emotional detachment, which I think we've seen that before in cases as well. It's hard to judge anybody based on their immediate reactions, 911 calls, and that kind of thing. So that's what the defense brought up. Several expert witnesses testified about adolescent brain development, which we now know goes like into your 20s. Like we're so dumb into our 20s, especially that impulse control, emotional regulation, and long-term reasoning are still forming at age 14. So they had a lot to weigh here. It wasn't just the, yes, we saw this. It was, did she have the mental and emotional capacity to know what she was doing? Was she acting in a way that she should be held accountable as an adult? This is a lot on this jury. It's not just guilty or not, which is big enough.
I've never been on a jury. I thought I was going to have to when I had jury duty, but this is not a decision I would want to make.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if they were there deliberating for a month because yeah. This is tough.
I would want to tap out and just be like, make somebody else make this decision. This is too tough. And the tension was felt throughout the courtroom and really throughout the community and everybody that knew this family throughout the entire trial and case. And it's actually still going on.
So after days of testimony, the prosecution and defense delivered their closing arguments. So let's kind of summarize those. The state attorney emphasized the brutality and planning that was evident in her actions and argued that life imprisonment was the only sentence fitting for someone who killed her mother. And for all, you know, she tried to kill her stepfather, but instead she just seriously wounded him. The defense pointed to her youth, her mental health history, and the need for a sentence that considered rehabilitation rather than just merely a punishment. So they also noted that there was a 40-year plea deal that had been offered earlier in the process, one that Carly ultimately chose not to accept because she wanted to, well, her team and her wanted to see how the jury would respond to all of those factors as well, her mental health, her being so young, that kind of thing.
And, you know, I don't know if I've ever heard of a 40-year plea deal. If I, in my almost mid-40s, maybe mid-40s, were offered a 40-year plea deal, I mean, what's the other option there? That's likely to be the rest of my life, given my health issues.
Yeah.
So,
and even her, I mean, she would have been, what, 55, 56 at the time? So that's no spring chicken anymore.
It's not. But for her, I mean, I guess an alternative possibility is 25 to life or something like that. So I don't know. I know Mississippi is a little stricter with their sentences, and well, I think we see that here.
And the alternative is the death sentence. If she's being tried as an adult, they could, you know, she could face the death penalty.
Right.
I was trying to think of what means they have. I don't think any states do in the electric chair, but I could see Mississippi still being one of those states.
No, I absolutely could too. So the jury deliberated for just 2 hours before reaching a verdict.
How, man?
I don't know. I assume that...
Well, I guess that's for the verdict and not for the sentencing.
Right.
I get that.
She was guilty on all counts. First degree murder, attempted murder, and tampering with evidence. For the murder of her mother and the attempted murder of her stepfather, she would receive later 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole. She also received 10 years for the tampering with evidence charge. The judge ordered these sentences to run concurrently, which is essentially they all run at the same time, not back to back. But a life sentence without parole in Mississippi is the rest of your natural life in prison. So she's not getting out. As of late 2025, when the latest news had been updated and records had been updated, Carly was incarcerated in the Youthful Offender Unit of the Central Mississippi Correctional Facility in Rankin County.
After the conviction, her defense filed an appeal with the Mississippi Supreme Court. They argued that her sentence was unconstitutional, giving her age, and citing that there were errors in jury instructions and trial procedure. The appeal contends that her mandatory life without parole sentence failed to adequately consider her youth, her developmental status, her mental health history, and the possibility that there was, you know, a shot that she could be rehabilitated. So citing all of that, they included a case that they thought was precedent, Miller versus Alabama, which limits such sentences for juveniles. And I thought that there was a federal law that limited how they could be sentenced when they were tried as adults if they were under a certain age.
I'm with you. And if this had happened in, like I said, the 90s, I fully see this happening. But
we covered a case early in our podcasting adventures where a young man shot his principal at a school. They did convict him and sentence him as if he was an adult, but then the new law that was passed, they had to go back and redo his sentencing because he was a minor at the time. So I really don't see how they get around that, but maybe it's not a federal law. Maybe I'm just thinking of a Tennessee state law.
No, I mean, that's come up in the Lily Lid murder case, which also was in Tennessee, but, yeah. I mean, if you'd asked me before this, I was positive that was a federal ruling that the Supreme Court said it's unconstitutional to sentence a minor to life.
I thought so as well. So it remains unclear when the state's high court will rule on the appeal, a decision that could have major implications for Carly's sentencing. So I think this is going to be one we'll have to keep you posted because appeals don't always move super quickly. So this is one I'm going to keep up with.
Yeah. We can process that a little bit more when we're wrapping up here, but I have opinions.
Well, what are they? Let's hear them.
I think a life sentence is too much for a 14-year-old. I think her mental health history was troubling. It wasn't enough to exclude her from culpability, so I'm fine with the guilty verdict. She's also 14, and I think it's immoral and unethical to put her in prison for the rest of her life. I would like to see her rehabilitated in some way. And I agreed with that federal ruling when it was made. Again, if she's 17 and like slaughtered a family, that's different than being 14, finding a gun in the home. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
I know that the day of the shooting, you know, that whole week had to be interesting from a mental health perspective. Like, why did you change Zoloft? So what decision led into that? Was she having mental health issues that they felt like another medication would have been more helpful? So then they made that change. How was that change going? Did it even have time to do anything? Because that's a medicine that needs weeks in your system. And just because you had Zoloft in your system doesn't automatically mean that medicine's immediately 100% effective.
Right.
Also on the day of the murder, a friend of Carly's approached Ashley because Ashley's a teacher at that school. And the friend was concerned that Carly had been trying marijuana.
Yeah.
So Ashley had to confront Carly at some point, whether that was on the drive home or in the house once they got home, about her marijuana use. She was using vape pens with THC. So this was one of those things that, like, there was already tension. And could the mental health medicine made her not able to fully use her facilities to say, yes, I'm upset and pissed at my mom, but that doesn't mean I want to kill her? How much control did she have of her actions? And some people might say, John, that's ridiculous. But I think it's a valid point that we just are not going to know the answer to.
So where do you land? Like, I'm fine with the conviction. I don't like the life sentence. Where do you oppose the conviction itself based on her mental health issues?
I don't think that this kid needs to spend the rest of her life in prison. I do think there's a balance between prison versus some kind of rehabilitation center. This girl needs mental health help severely. So I would like to see her, you know, go through a facility where they can really make sure they have that under control and get her in a much better spot. That's what I would like to see happen. Now, as far as how long she needs to be there, I don't know. I don't know that I have a good answer for
I don't think there's a number. I think it's when she's able to demonstrate the ability to, with the help of medication and therapy, deal with her emotions and be a productive member of society. I don't even know that you put a, maybe you put a minimum on it. You say 20 years to life. You can get probation after 20 years or if 20 to 30. Yeah.
Like contingent on feeling like you have been rehabilitated.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. But yeah, this one's tough, man. Really, really tough.
I really am shocked that they did the life sentence. I think they shouldn't have, and I hope that that appeal goes through. But she does deserve to spend time being, you know, well, being helped with her mental health, but also paying for what she did.
Yeah. Jamie, this was a good one, man. Thank you for bringing it to us today.
Yeah, a lot of things to think about. I still don't think we got to the why of... We don't see long-term blow-ups with the mom. We don't know if there was one big incident. Usually there are early signs of distress but in a relationship when we see these incidents happen within homes. But I don't know. I think a lot of it goes back to her state of mind and maybe has less to do with her relationship with Ashley.
Guys, thank you all so much for tuning in. Don't forget, we do have Patreon. We just released an episode over the weekend or two weekends ago because I've forgotten what day it is because I'm snowed in.
It's The Murder of Louise Soselsky, and I cannot find another podcast on it anywhere. So not only is it exclusive for our audience, but it's a pretty exclusive case to talk about.
For sure. Guys, we appreciate you. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
Listen to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.